It functions as a plunger.
But what was the universe?
A little bit naive.
A certain sort of magic.
Mate, what have you got against Mike?
Let's dip together.
You're not in charge, Tommy's.
Hello, Tom Tilley with you for Hack. Overnight, we got the news that a US nurse contracted Ebola while working in a Texas hospital.
At some point, there was a breach in protocol.
Today, we're going to find out what the plan is if someone got Ebola here in Australia. And as tens of thousands of Year 12 students shuffle into the exam halls around the country, what's your tip for staying sane?
Hack. No, I don't want you to worry, class. These tests will have no effect on your grade. They merely determine your future social status and financial success.
On Triple J with Tom Tilley.
All right, let's go to the Middle East first. And over the weekend, Islamic State militants have killed dozens of people in car bombings around Iraq. Meanwhile, right near the Syria-Turkey border, Kurdish fighters are struggling to hold on to the city of Kobani. In just a moment, we'll find out why Turkish armed forces are standing back, letting it happen. First, Sarah McVee gives you the latest details on the attacks made by the Islamic State.
Anbar province stretches from the west of the Iraqi capital Baghdad to the Syrian border. It's an area under siege by the so-called Islamic State.
Just today, they succeeded to assassinate the commander-in-chief of Anbar province.
Al Jazeera's Baghdad correspondent Swadad El Sali told RN Breakfast up to 50,000 IS fighters are in the area, with numbers heading across from Syria.
The situation in Anbar is very important for them. This means that they will be able to reach Baghdad in just a few days.
But violence has already broken out in Baghdad. The ABC reports that on Saturday night, a suicide bomber drove his car into a security checkpoint in the north of Baghdad. 13 people died and 28 were wounded. And in Shula, in the northwest of the capital, another two car bombs killed dozens more.
A car bomb exploded here at the checkpoint, killing and wounding several people. My son was seriously injured.
But the biggest attack happened in the north of Iraq. Up to 40 Kurdish Peshmerga veterans are thought to have been killed at a security compound. Site, a website that monitors terrorist activity, says IS has claimed responsibility and that three foreign fighters from Germany, Saudi Arabia and Turkey were involved.
Car bombings are very popular. They're very effective.
John Blaxland is a senior fellow at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU. He says despite the spate of car bombings in Baghdad, it's highly unlikely the capital will fall to IS.
Simply because the Shiites dominate.
He says the reason IS have dominated in Anbar is because it's a Sunni region and the mostly Shia Iraqi military finds it harder to operate there.
Anbar province was always Sunni territory. It's never been territory that the Shiite-dominated Iraqi army has ever really felt comfortable operating in.
They have the capability to strike pretty much anywhere in the country.
Andrew Davies from the Strategic Policy Institute says IS are changing their strategy in light of coalition airstrikes.
They're not bunching up like an army and presenting nice targets for an airstrike. They're now starting to do things where they blend into the civil population and strike at a time and place of their choosing.
Hello again. I'm John Cantley, the British citizen abandoned by my government and a prisoner of the Islamic State for nearly 2 years.
Over the weekend, IS released a fourth propaganda video featuring captured British journalist John Cantley. In the video, he warns that coalition intervention will fail to thwart IS.
The Islamic State will survive and even thrive. In the face of setbacks, war only makes the jihadist movement stronger.
It is going to take a period of time to bring the coalition thoroughly to the table.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry.
To rebuild some of the morale and capacity of the Iraqi army and to begin to focus where we ought to be focusing first, which is in Iraq. It is Iraqis who will have to take back Iraq.
But while the coalition's focus is on Iraq, another battlefront has captured the world's attention. IS has been attacking Kobani, a town in Syria on the Turkish-Syrian border, for almost 1 month. A week ago, they raised their black flag there. Just over the border, Turkish tanks are in view of the carnage. And while the Turkish government has refused to send troops, 200,000 people have been forced to flee Kobani and surrounding areas. According to Al Jazeera, activists say 400 people have been killed in the fighting.
Kobani does not define the strategy of the coalition. Kobani is one community, and it's a tragedy of what is happening.
Many analysts believe it's only a matter of time before Kobani falls to IS.
The Turkish government is very cautious at this stage simply because it does not want to really provide any assistance which could benefit the Kurds.
Professor Amin Saykul is the director of the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the ANU. He says the Turkish government are hesitant to assist in the fight against IS because they don't want to empower the Turkish separatists known as the PKK, who they've been in a violent conflict with for several decades.
And also at the same time, they have said that they don't want to do it on their own. Obviously, if there's going to be a coordinated NATO ground attack against the IS in Kobani, then the Turks will participate, but they simply, at this point, they don't want to do it on their own.
Sarah McVee reporting, and as you heard, the city of Kobani is just on the Syrian side of the Syria-Turkey border. It's a major border crossing point into Turkey, and it's been under attack from Islamic State fighters for several weeks. Now, you might think that Turkey would naturally want to secure this city from the advancing Islamic State fighters. The US would certainly like them to, and so would the Kurds, who are about to lose their city. But it's way more complex than that. To explain why Turkey isn't rushing in to get involved in the fight for Kobani, we have Roger Shanahan on the line. He's a former army officer. He's worked with the UN in the Middle East, and he's a Middle East politics fellow at the Lowy Institute. Roger, thanks for joining us. In the fight against Islamic State, what would be the strategic benefit of stopping the fall of Kobani to the Islamic State?
Well, Islamic State appear to have invested quite a deal of resources in trying to take hold of Kobani, so it has significant symbolic value both for Islamic State if they can press forward their advantage in the face of the airstrikes they've been suffering, but conversely, if they fail to take it, then it's a blow to both their reputation and stalls their momentum again.
Okay, we've been seeing pictures of Turkish troops sitting in tanks watching the battle from just behind the border. What are the key reasons they're not intervening?
Well, most of the Kurdish fighters in Kobani belong to the YPG, which is a Syrian-Kurdish offshoot of PKK, which is a listed terrorist organisation in many governments and one that the Turkish government has been fighting for decades. So there's a sense that President Erdogan is not particularly enamoured of providing assistance to an offshoot of one of his domestic enemies, regardless of who they're fighting.
Yeah, it's interesting, that choice by Turkey. Are they choosing to score points against an old domestic ally rather than stop the march of the Islamic State?
Well, in fact, you know, at the moment, from the reports, the fighting in and around Kobani has been pretty significant. So you could argue that from Turkey's point of view, they're winning by degrading Islamic State, who are trying to press forward an advantage and have been taking significant casualties. And at the same time, YPG, so the friend of a close friend of one of Turkey's enemies, is also taking a hammering. So two groups that Turkey really has no truck with are both fighting each other in a significant bloody battle. So Turkey has really no particular reason other than a humanitarian one to intervene. At the same time, it's a border crossing, but Turkey has sealed off its side of the border, so there's limited strategic value in having a border crossing that you can't actually cross through.
Yeah, it's a funny situation though, isn't it? As you explain, it's in Turkey's interest to watch two of their enemies, I guess, grind each other down. But in terms of the bigger fight, Turkey's part of NATO. They've signed up to be part of the US-led coalition. What about the bigger picture here? What role are they going to take there?
Well, certainly Turkey's in quite a strong bargaining position in one sense, but a weak one in another. You could argue that Turkey's recalcitrance and President Erdogan's fixation on getting rid of Assad without thought about what was to follow or what plan B was if Assad didn't fall quickly, you could argue that that kind of policy approach has assisted the growth of Islamist forces in Syria. So in one, on one hand, they've been complicit through commission or omission of assisting the build-up of Islamist forces in Syria. But on the other hand, as you pointed out, Parliament, Turkish Parliament, has authorised assistance against Islamic State. But exactly what form that assistance hasn't been particularised, because that's the government's prerogative. At the moment, there's talk about Turkey providing basing for training of so-called moderate rebels and and perhaps NATO use of its Incirlik air base, which the Americans have been very keen to utilise.
Now, there's lots of Western journalists shooting back very quickly, very powerful images of this conflict around Kobani. We've seen those pictures of the IS flags flying from buildings in Kobani. We've seen those pictures I mentioned before of Turkish tanks sitting on the border, not actually doing anything, pictures of tear gas against Kurdish demonstrators. Is this story just grabbing our attention because the media can actually get to it, or is this one of the most strategically important battles at the moment?
No, I think it's the former rather than the latter. There's significant fighting going on in Iraq, particularly and Western approaches to Baghdad, but there are no real reporters from there, so it's pretty well invisible to the world. But if you've got a bunch of reporters on one side of a border looking at significant fighting on a town on the other side of the border, and you can provide not only images but live commentary of it, then that place becomes quite significant in media terms, but not necessarily as significant in military or strategic terms.
Roger, great to speak to you and hear your analysis. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure.
That's Roger Shanahan from the Lowy Institute. On the text line, someone says, Turks don't care about Kurdish civilians. I hope the caliphate treats the Turks exactly how they've treated the Peshmerga.
Hack.
You cannot contract Ebola by walking by people in the street.
On Triple J with Tom Tilley.
Just days after the first person died from Ebola on American soil, a nurse who was working with that man has been diagnosed with a deadly disease. She was working in a world-class facility in Texas, which makes the idea of working in West Africa really scary. Now, in a moment, we're going to find out what the plan is if someone contracts Ebola here in Australia. First, Joe Lauder looks at how the world's reacting to the American case.
While this is obviously bad news, it is not news that should bring about panic.
It's bad news for the fight against Ebola. A second person infected outside Africa and the first transmission within America. The nurse who tested positive for Ebola was wearing full protective equipment whilst caring for Thomas Duncan, who travelled from Liberia with the virus and died last week. Director of the Centre for Diseases Control, Dr. Tom Frieden.
We don't know what occurred in the care of the index patient, the original patient in Dallas. But at some point, there was a breach in protocol, and that breach in protocol resulted in this infection.
Healthcare workers are at the Ebola front line, and in West Africa, around 300 health professionals have died.
The care of Ebola can be done safely, but it's hard to do it safely. It requires meticulous and scrupulous attention to infection control.
The US is also ramping up airport screenings for passengers coming from infected countries.
I think the United States, like Australia, is very well placed to respond to a disease outbreak of this nature.
Dr. Adam Camrad-Scott is a former nurse and now researches infectious diseases at Sydney Uni's Centre for International Security Studies. He says the infection of the Dallas nurse probably happened when she was taking off her protective gear or during a high-risk procedure.
There's always risks associated with taking off that equipment. Mr. Duncan was also intubated, which means he had a tube down his throat and was on a ventilator. And that certainly raises or increases the risk.
In Australia, we've had our own scare with Ebola. Nurse and Red Cross worker Sue Ellen Kovac has recently returned from volunteering in Sierra Leone, and she was quarantined last week after developing a low-grade fever. Her two tests for the virus have come back negative, but as a precaution, she'll be staying in home isolation for the three-week incubation period.
The measures that she's taken, the vigilance that she displayed, really is commendable.
But MP Bob Catter thinks people who volunteer in West Africa are putting their fellow countrymen at risk.
I would have some caution about allowing people to go over there. Now, all right, that may not sound very Christian of me, but if you go over there, you do not put your own country at threat. And that is what has happened here.
In West Africa, the Ebola death toll is now above 4,000, up by 1,000 in the past fortnight. Dr. Adam Camrad-Scott says we might be running out of time to stop Ebola from spreading out of that region.
There is the potential, for instance, of further outbreaks emerging in places like Asia or South America, or, you know, we've already seen a couple of cases appear in Europe. And if some of the other countries that also have poor health infrastructure see cases arrive, then we could end up in a very different set of circumstances very quickly.
Meanwhile, Australia's commitment to the international effort to stop Ebola is still copping a lot of criticism. The Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, has reiterated that Australia won't be sending any teams over there because they can't be evacuated back home if they're infected.
Yeah, with respect to the Prime Minister, I don't think that that would be the best set of circumstances. We don't really want to be transporting people that are highly infectious and quite unwell, and seeing them on planes for more than 24 hours to get them back to Australia. And indeed, this is one of the reasons why the UK government has helped establish a healthcare facility in Sierra Leone. I believe there were 12 beds that have been dedicated for international health workers.
Hack Triple J.
That's Dr. Adam Camrad-Scott, a former nurse and infectious diseases researcher at the Centre for International Security Studies, ending Joe Lauder's report. Sean on the text line from Mount Gambier, any Australian who is in West Africa at the moment should not be allowed back into Australia. Send them to Manus Island or Christmas Island. It's too dangerous. And Johnny in Melbourne says, if they want to protect the world from Ebola, then stop all flights in and out of Africa. Sounds like some people are maybe a bit scared and fearful and, intensely worried and giving some very full-on solutions there about what we should do of people coming in and out of Africa and mitigating the risk of contracting Ebola. But it's very important to know what the plan is here in Australia if someone does contract Ebola or carries Ebola onto Australian soil. And to help us find out what that plan is, we have Dr. Grant Hill-Cawthorne, who's a lecturer in communicable diseases at Sydney Uni. He's with us, and he also researches in conjunction with Westmead Hospital, which is where anyone in New South Wales will go if they do have Ebola. Grant, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Grant, given the nurse in America was working in a world-class facility in Texas, how concerned are you that she contracted Ebola there?
It is worrying. Certainly, most of what we've been saying so far is that when we are faced with healthcare workers within developed countries, there's far less risk of them getting the infection compared to, say, in West Africa. And that's simply because we expect infection control to be much more diligent, to have practiced many of these procedures, and to actually have all the equipment available. So this is a bit of a surprise.
What's the plan if someone contracted Ebola here or carried Ebola into Australia? What would we do?
We've actually got a different plan to the US. So originally, the US was going to deal with any Ebola cases at the hospital that they first present to, which is why Dallas Presbyterian was dealing with this Liberian case. We've got a slightly different approach in Australia, which is we've got designated quarantine hospitals in each state. We've got between one and three of those, depending upon the state. And as you say, for New South Wales, that's Westmead Hospital. So we would, as soon as we've identified a case, transfer them to that designated hospital, where they would be put in a room that has a negative pressure, so you don't get air escaping out of it. And we've got staff that have trained and practiced and rehearsed, taken off, personal protective equipment, who would then be caring for that patient.
Okay, but how would you get the patient to the hospital? And let's think about the case last week. If Sue Ellen Kovac had actually had Ebola, she was in Cairns Hospital, what would have happened next?
So Sue Ellen Kovac actually presented to the correct hospital. So Cairns Hospital is one of the three Queensland hospitals. So she was already in the correct place. She'd already been put into the isolation unit there and was being treated by the infectious disease team that had already practiced for this. So Queensland's response there was perfectly in line with what we'd expect. If someone presented, for example, to North Shore Hospital in Sydney, we would have an ambulance that would then take them over, and then that ambulance would be quarantined until it's disinfected, and the ambulance crew would obviously be wearing personal protective equipment to protect them. So most of the time, we'll be picking up these cases at a very early stage, and there is very, very little risk of transmission.
Okay, I want to go to a doctor who's gotten back from Sierra Leone recently, and as we heard in Joe Lauder's story, the Australian government are not willing to send Australians to West Africa until there is an evacuation plan in place, but a number of Australians have been in West Africa working for NGOs like Medecins Sans Frontières and Red Cross. And Dr. Jenny Steadman was in Sierra Leone, working with the Red Cross until last month. And she was also working with the Australian nurse Sue Ellen Kovac, who was suspected of having Ebola last week. And as we've heard, she was cleared and is now quarantined at home. Jenny, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, Jenny, if a nurse working in a well-resourced hospital in Texas can contract Ebola, should that make us even more worried about Australians or anyone working in West Africa?
Look, I think that everybody has a right to be concerned about what has been happening, and it is what people have said, that there is a very small risk, but they have to understand that unless we can stop the spread of the disease where it is endemic at the moment, we're unlikely to stop picking up every patient that might come in from West Africa. So realistically, we need to keep our concentration on the effort that we're making to help them fight the spread of the disease on the ground, and then we won't have to worry about it coming out here. But I think people also maybe don't understand the degree of caution that people are taking, and that the provision of the best personal protection equipment in the field that is provided by the Red Cross and Médecins Sans Frontières. So I think the best efforts are being made to actually minimise the risk of anyone coming back with Ebola.
Okay, the government here says a major hurdle in sending Australian support is not having a safe evacuation plan. You were working in West Africa for the Red Cross. What was your evacuation plan?
Of course, I work for, that's an international federation of the Red Cross. I was over there, and of course, if there had been any problem with any of their workers while over there, then I'm sure they would have had the capacity to get them either to the nearest facility inside Sierra Leone or to Geneva. But I hasten to add that no one actually had any signs or symptoms of the disease as they've come back so far.
Okay. Now, we had this scare last week in Queensland when your colleague Sue Ellen went to hospital suspected of having Ebola, but we heard that she followed the correct protocols having returned from West Africa. What are the protocols for you guys when you return from West Africa?
We obviously come through customs, we're greeted by someone from quarantine who goes over the protocol for us, and that is that we take our temperature twice a day because one of the first signs is a fever. And that we would report immediately any symptoms. As I think you were hearing a moment ago, I am working at Redland Hospital, and so Royal Brisbane was my designated hospital. So I knew that if I got any signs or symptoms, that I would go present immediately to there, phone the Department of Health, and present at that hospital, as Sue Ellen did at her appropriate hospital facility.
Okay, and are you going back anytime soon?
I don't think my work will let me go back right now. Mm. Obviously, they've had a shortage for 7 weeks as I went for a month, and then I've just completed my 21-day quarantine at home period. So I think they're quite glad to have me back at work today. It's my first day back, and it's a pleasure to be back at work.
All right, Jenny, great to speak to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
All right, that was Jenny Steadman, who's a doctor who worked with the Red Cross in Sierra Leone helping stop the spread of Ebola. And in the studio we have Dr. Grant Hill-Cawthorne talking about our plan here in Australia if someone did contract Ebola. Now, in the wake of the news from the US, Grant, the health minister here in Australia has been trying to calm fears about how Ebola actually spreads. Now, I think most people would rather hear this explanation from you than a politician. This is actually what you do. How is Ebola transmitted?
So it's relatively difficult to transmit. So the virus is only present in bodily fluids. So that's blood, diarrhea, vomit. And so it requires direct contact with one of those bodily fluids. And that needs to enter through your mucous membrane. So through your eye or through your mouth in order to be infected. So it's not something that can be transmitted via the air. It's not something you'd catch from someone sneezing nearby. So it's really only people in very close contact who are caring for patients that are actually quite sick, who actually have diarrhea, vomit, or are bleeding, who are actually at risk.
Okay, there's a very succinct explanation of how it's transferred. I'm sure there's a lot more detail to go into, and I think a lot of people need to find out more so that they can quell those fears that seem to be overtaking a lot of people. Grant, great to speak to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Dr. Grant Hill-Cawthorne from Sydney University. He's a lecturer in communicable disease epidemiology. And if you want to find more information on how you can and can't contract Ebola, we've actually put up a handy myth-busting post on on the HAC website. So check that out, jj.net.au/hack. That's jj.net.au/hack to get the do's and don'ts or the how you can and can't contract Ebola. Kat on the text line from Melbourne says, healthcare workers know what they're getting into when they volunteer to fight Ebola. I applaud them for it. It is a crisis in countries like Sierra Leone and the world is obligated to help. I trust healthcare workers to do the right thing and not expose Australians.
Hack.
A lot of people that I know don't admit when they're suffering from depression or anxiety and the fear of looking soft.
On Triple J with Tom Tilley.
Now, a big shout out to anyone who donated to the ABC's mental health campaign last week. We had a fascinating week-long look at mental health issues here on HAC and right across Triple J and the ABC, and it culminated in a star-studded TV broadcast on ABC on Friday night. And the goal was to raise $1 million. But early in the day on Friday, that only raised about $200,000. But I can announce that after the Friday night broadcast, the total funds raised hit the target. It actually now sits at a whopping $1.4 million, which is really amazing. So well done to anyone that chucked in some cash. And I think well done to anyone who got interested or involved or took anything from the whole week discussing mental health last week. It was a fascinating week and it raised lots of interesting issues and ideas. And if there's anything that you would like us to follow up on the HAC program, you can send us an email, hack@abc.net.au. That's hack@abc.net.au.
Hack. I was like, I can't do it. Hi, I need help.
On Triple J with Tom Tilley.
Now, as we heard last week, Year 12 can be a really stressful time and it can push people into suffering from mental illnesses. And Reach Out launched a whole campaign with well-known people basically saying that there was life after Year 12. And I was a part of that as well. And I can vouch personally there is life after Year 12. But when you're in the middle of the exams, it feels like it could be the end of you. Well, today in New South Wales, tens of thousands of students sat their first big Year 12 exam. It was English, which is a pretty hard one. Now, if you sat this exam, I'd love to hear how you fared. Give me a call, 1300 055536 or text 04 3975 7555. Other states are going to file into the exam halls in the next few weeks as well. So we thought it was a good time to talk about how you keep the stress and anxiety levels under control. Dr. Viviana Wuthrich is a senior lecturer at Macquarie Uni and she's done extensive research into Year 12 exam stress. Viviana, thank you for joining us.
No problem.
Now, it'd be alarming if you weren't nervous or anxious about your Year 12 exams, but how many people end up with clinical mental health problems because of Year 12 exams?
Well, actually, it's a really good point that you bring up because, in fact, it is really helpful to be a little bit stressed when we're trying to perform to the best of our ability because some stress will actually help us to perform better. So the Australian research shows us that about 40% of Australian students do experience stress, which we would consider to be moderate to severe. And in fact, that level of stress is probably okay for a short period of time. But about 10 to maybe 20% of students experience very severe levels of stress. And they are the sorts of students that probably could do with a little bit of help.
Help in terms of medication or psychological support?
Well, psychological support, perhaps. It might be medication as well. Certainly it would help if they could just sit down and have a chat to someone who can just help them to be realistic and clear about their goals and what's kind of going on. Because one of the main problems we see for anyone when they're experiencing stress, but particularly in that HSC year, is students will start to catastrophise and blow out of proportion how bad the HSC is going to be. Sometimes we just need someone to sit down and say, you know what, it's going to be okay.
Well, speaking of getting help, you've actually developed a cognitive behavioural therapy to try and de-stress Year 12 students. And I assume it doesn't involve just telling them to chill out and not to stress.
You're right.
How does your therapy work?
Yeah, so look, there was certainly a need in the market to target HSC stress. We know that there are a couple of factors that will really help to reduce stress. Now, we've applied this to HSC stress, but these are stress management techniques you can use in any stressful situation. One of the biggest factors when we're feeling stress is catastrophic thinking in a really negative way. All right, so lots of HSC students at the moment are focused on, I won't get the mark that I want, I won't be able to get a job, I can't cope with all this pressure. And that type of thinking just increases stress levels and makes it more difficult for them to be productive. So a core element of the program is teaching students just to step back a little bit and kind of check their thoughts, trying to come back to be a more realistic place.
Which I guess is much harder in practice than in theory. Viviana, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank
That's
you.
Viviana Woodrich from Macquarie Uni talking about how you can try and keep your Year 12 exams in perspective as they kick off around Australia. And Andrew in Picton says, Tom, please let people know they can get an exception from an HSC exam if they're suffering from a mental illness. Only a few people know this, and I wouldn't be here today without it. Thank you so much for all your calls and texts today. We are out of time. Linda Mariano is up next with Good Nights. I'll catch you tomorrow at 5:30.